I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of January. I'm sure many of you had a chance to see this fascinating piece on 60 Minutes. I think it was last week or maybe it was the week before. And it featured our guest this hour. One of the segments did. Our guest is Sean Carroll, and Sean was interviewed about the possibility of the return of all things, the woolly mammoth. Wouldn't it be something if there were woolly mammoths still alive? There is a possibility of that right now through cloning, and he was talking about that. So we'll talk with him about that, but many other things as well. Sean is an award-winning scientist, author, and educator. He's professor of molecular biology and genetics and an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute at the University of Wisconsin. His research has been centering on the genes that control animal body patterns and play major roles in the evolution of animal diversity. Discoveries from his lab have been featured in Time, U.S. News and World Report, The New York Times, Discover, and Natural History. He is the author of, and this book actually has become a National Book Award finalist, Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origin of Species. He's also the author of a monthly column in the New York Times, Remarkable Creatures. He's written many other books. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And we're so happy to have him with us this hour to talk about just a variety of wonderful explorers and woolly mammoths and more. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 8655, and the email address talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Sean Carroll, hello. Thanks for being with us again. It's great to have you on the air.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so much fun to watch you on 60 Minutes talking about woolly mammoths. Woolly mammoths, I said, they could make a return?
Well, it was fun to talk to 60 Minutes about it, but you have to also, in case your listeners are wondering, gee, maybe I missed that. At the very same time, the Packers were in that 45-45 overtime game.
Oh.
So I'm not sure the Nielsen ratings for 60 Minutes that week were as high as they normally are in Wisconsin.
Well, I think I must have taped you then because my family would have been watching that game. Not that I was, but I must have taped you and watched it a little bit later. How did they find you for that? Why did you get tapped for that?
Well, the interview I did maybe 6 months ago or so, they were thinking of a long piece on everything from sort of bringing back dinosaurs and what did we know about the making of ancient creatures. And so I sat down with Leslie Stahl for a long, maybe a couple-hour interview.
Oh.
I think it was towards the end of last May. And they wound up using parts of that interview in two different segments, a segment that ran, I think, in mid-November or so that focused on Jack Horner and dinosaurs and soft tissue from dinosaurs, a clip that they used, a longer clip they used of me on their online segment, talking about the sort of the backdrop of the science of understanding the making of creatures, and then about the DNA record and about bringing back extinct creatures and things like that. They used another segment for this story about woolly mammoths and about trying to either preserve things that are endangered or recover things that were extinct.
Interesting. And you were talking about the DNA that we can find just from the hair, and we've got a lot of woolly mammoths hairs in the museums, at least, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, and there's new finds all the time of woolly mammoths. That, because they were ice age creatures, they were buried. A lot of them are buried in frost and snow and ice, and so they're still being exposed. And so you have the hope that there might be some really well preserved cells and things like that. But at least in terms of preservation of the creatures, there've been some really fabulous finds of woolly mammoths, over recent years.
Mm-hmm. But we would need more than the DNA from a hair to be able to get another woolly mammoth?
Right. There's really two paths you can think about in terms of trying to bring them back. They're related to living elephants, but they're different. And the number of genetic changes between woolly mammoths and living elephants would be pretty large. And we really don't have certainly anything we could use off the shelf as a technology to try to engineer elephant DNA to be like woolly mammoth DNA. So that's the more exotic approach, let's say. The approach you could imagine, because there's a lot going on these days of cloning, trying to grow individuals that are really begin as cells from the body as opposed to, you know, natural reproduction. And one could imagine that if a mammoth has been well-preserved, either in its hair or skin or any other cells in the body, that if there's not been much decay in that cell of the genetic material, that that might be usable in a cloning procedure, then you'd use an elephant as a surrogate. So we're only talking about a few thousand years since woolly mammoths disappeared, so it's a completely different ballgame if your listeners are thinking about Jurassic Park, which the dinosaurs disappeared 65 million years ago. Well, there's, to our knowledge, there's no significant detectable DNA in any dinosaur specimen. So a few thousand years is a lot more recoverable than 65 million years old.
And what if the elephant had the woolly mammoth? Would the elephant take care of the animal?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm not quite sure, but I think, you know, if we... sorry, I mean, you know, that's science.
Who knows?
Right? I couldn't, you know, place 100% confidence in that. But I think that, you know, they're close relatives, and obviously those instincts are there for an elephant. I guess that would be the hope, is that there would be nothing so different about a mammoth born to an elephant that they wouldn't get maternal care. But in terms of gestation and all that, I think the environment would be close enough that we'd be fairly confident that a mammoth embryo could develop normally. And that's been the experience. In fact, that was the other piece of work that was highlighted in that 60 Minutes piece, was work going on in trying to rescue species from sort of the brink by using surrogate mothers, for example, for, you know, rare cats, using, you know, pretty common cats or, you know, using tigers or lions or whatever for as surrogate mothers. So that, I think there's a fair amount of confidence that surrogacy would work for some of these creatures.
So would it be a good thing, and if so, why, and if not, why, to have a woolly mammoth around again?
Well, I mean, anyone can have their own opinion on this. I think that what the angle I took in the interview and that I believe in is that, you know, these sorts of projects, they inspire our imagination, they inspire our wonder, and I know that my own 10-year-old niece would like to do something like this, and that, you know, we need to nourish the next generation with imaginative, you know, scientific ambitions. And so either preserving the species that are here on the planet or bringing back those that are recently extinct, you know, is something like that. Now, you know, there's all sorts of arguments one could make. Is, you know, is this something that we should do? Well, you know, humans probably had a pretty big hand in mammoths going extinct. We definitely hunted them. So, you know, perhaps this would just be like making reparations, right? So, you know, and I think we would only do this, you know, on a small scale, and obviously, I'm, you know, people are equally concerned about living elephant populations, so we wouldn't want to, you know, distract people from other matters that are at hand. But I would, my view mostly rests on this point of imagination and of inspiring, you know, people to explore sort of the frontiers of science and what may be possible. And I certainly don't see a great downside to it.
Mm-hmm. So we did hunt them to extinction, Professor Carroll?
Well, we contributed to them for sure. I mean, there's no doubt that mammoths were hunted by humans. You can, you know, find in their bones, you can find piles of their bones in various places, you know, that are clearly marked with, you know, from tool markings and hatchets and spear tips and things like that from humans. So we contributed to their decline in numbers. And environmental circumstances also shifted because all sorts of Ice Age mammals are gone, you know, from saber-toothed cats to giant sloths and dire wolves and things like this. If you want sort of a portrait of what was around only about 12,000 years ago, you can get that at the La Brea Tar Pits, a spectacular deposit of fossils that were trapped in tar pits right in the middle of what is now downtown Los Angeles. Great museum there, and so if you're in that neighborhood and you want to know what was here just about 12,000 years ago, you can see all these in magnificent preservation. But combination of environmental change and hunting is the general idea.
Let's welcome a couple phone calls that have come in, and we'll continue. We're going to talk about many different topics with Sean. We start our calls with Mark from Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Sure.
It seems pretty impractical using elephants as surrogates for cloning mammoths because of their long gestation period and length of time it would take to bring them to maturity. I was wondering if anyone's looked at using Hyrax. They're directly related to elephants, and they're really short lifespan or their age at maturity is only like 16 months or something like that.
You're right that hyrax and actually manatees and elephants are fairly closely related to each other. But, of course, there's going to be a body size problem there with a hyrax. So as that woolly mammoth embryo grows, you've got to be in an animal that's large enough that can handle it.
The hyrax is small, furry animal.
Small,
right?
Yeah. These are all mammals, but they're all small. So I think the idea of using an elephant, yes, the gestation time is long, but the body size of a mammoth or an elephant at term is so large that I think we'd have to use an elephant as a surrogate.
Hmm. Well, we'll have some pygmy mammoths maybe come with those little.
Well, there's another approach. Maybe we should start small. That's right.
There you go. Good luck in your endeavors.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mark, very much for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. So are you actively pursuing this at Madison in the work that you're doing?
No,
you're not.
Thank you for asking me that question. No, I just happen to be, in the general realm of evolutionary biology and what we can learn from the DNA record of evolution and from ancient DNA and things like this. So, I was a little concerned in doing in that part of the interview that people might confuse that this is actually what I'm doing. It's not
right.
What I'm doing, but at sometimes I'm sort of called to just represent what's going on in this broad discipline of biology, and that was the case. So no, I'm not doing anything here. I'm working with much more manageable creatures like insects.
Right. Let's talk about insects. I love your piece in the New York Times because who thinks about these things? I guess a lot of us do actually, but you write in your recent piece, January 19th, actually, as the mercury plunges to its animal lows, those of us at higher latitudes retreat to cozy shelters. But what in the world? We don't give much thought to the insects and the spiders that inhabited the backyard or the woods in the summer. We know about the birds and the squirrels, but what about those insects and spiders? What made you think of them, write about them, and what did you discover?
Well, I've been interested in animals in extreme climates. I should sort of explain that this column I write for the New York Times, which is dubbed Remarkable Creatures, I'm sort of trying to use interesting creatures from around the world to engage people to think about natural history and how animals do cope and how they adapt. And a lot of these creatures have astounding adaptation. So I've been interested in life in extreme environments. I was a little bit familiar with how for example, fish in the Antarctic had coped with very low water temperatures so that they wouldn't essentially become fish sticks. But it's even harder on insects because they're exposed to even deeper cold. And the question is, how do they get by? And, Wisconsin's pretty challenging, but imagine the interior of Alaska where, you might get to 100 below Fahrenheit, fairly frequently. So I looked into this, and again, this is work it's not my personal work, this is just my reporting. A lot of scientists have been interested in adaptation to cold, and all sorts of bugs and other creatures have been studied, and the interesting thing that has emerged is that there have been all sorts of independent solutions invented in different insects. So they've come up with various chemical recipes for antifreezes, and what these antifreezes generally do is they suppress the ability of ice crystals to grow. So they sort of latch on to crystals when they're of molecular size, so they can't grow into big crystals and distort cells and damage tissues and essentially freeze the animal. In other cases, though, there are bugs that pretty much freeze, but what they need to do is they need to do that in a controlled way. So flash freezing is going to destroy tissues, and when that bug thaws out, it's going to be dead. But a steady, slow freezing where it's on a more controlled rate and also a more controlled thawing without refreezing, some bugs can do this. And so, for example, in the story I talk about this Alaskan beetle that while it freezes at 19 below Fahrenheit, it can survive exposure to about 100 below Fahrenheit.
Hmm.
And I think that's a pretty remarkable beast.
I would say so. A real remarkable beast. Isn't it amazing how animals adapt to this? I mean, it's just amazing.
And I think we have to think about, Kathleen, this has been going on, for several hundred million years. So the animal kingdom is probably around the order of about 600 million years old. And to fill all the space that's on the planet, they're living in some fringe environments, whether that's high altitude or deep water or cold temperatures or maybe very hot temperatures. And so that battle against nature has led to so much innovation over the hundreds of millions of years. And what you see just in insects alone are several different independent innovations of creatures living in different parts of the world and in cold climates. So it does show the tremendous sort of creativity that exists in nature and of the evolutionary process.
The fish, you write about the fish that have these antifreeze proteins. So are they, where are they? They're in the water, but are they just kind of stationary during the time that it's really cold? Or are
they? Well, they have a pretty low metabolism. So these fish are around in the Southern Ocean around the continent of the Antarctic, and those water temperatures are too cold for more northern fish. So, those waters are full of, you've seen icebergs, but also you may have seen, if you've seen underwater footage, that you'll see slush and ice crystals sort of floating in the water. Well, those are a hazard to those fish because if those fish, say, ingest a small ice crystal just while feeding, that ice crystal can start the formation of really ice blocks inside the animal and essentially freeze them from the inside out. So, ice grows, as you can see on your windshield or anything else, grows as this crystalline growth. And that's what you've got to suppress from happening inside bodies and inside cells. Hmm. And so what these fish have come up with, and there's about 120 species of fish that have this protein antifreeze that drops the freezing temperature of their blood just far enough that it's below the minimum temperature of the water they live in. Hmm. And that little margin that they've evolved gives them a huge advantage because those fish now make up about 90% of the fish in the Southern Ocean. So they sort of dominate that area. So that area where we know that perhaps 30 to 40 million years ago, there were typical sharks and flounders and skates and all that in those waters, those fish are all gone. The whole area has been taken over by these antifreeze-bearing fish.
Oh, that's interesting. And what about us? I've often wondered, and now I have you on the air, so I can ask you, and you'll know the answer. I've also wondered, people, sometimes it gets to be really cold in this climate, as you well know. I wonder how people who were explorers, who were looking at Wisconsin not all that long ago, people who had to live outside, how did they do that? Did they have some kind of antifreeze themselves that we've lost years?
They borrowed the animal secret, which was, of course, furs, right? So they wrapped themselves in furs and skins, and so they borrowed from their furry cousins of the mammal world and wrapped themselves in layers. And I can't even imagine, Kathleen. I mean, this is not a long time ago, right?
I know.
The generation of explorers that settled, not just North America, but so many other parts of the world, it's pretty hard to imagine putting yourself in their shoes of what they encountered in terms of scarcity of food, extreme climate, difficulties in transportation, just getting from one place to the next, encountering, enormous lakes or mountain ranges or whatever it might be. But in terms of the extreme cold, I think that it was fur and fire that got them through.
Yeah. We'll welcome more phone calls for you. Sean Carroll is our guest this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. He's a professor of genetics and molecular biology at UW-Madison, investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and director of the Carroll Laboratory. His books include The Making of the Fittest and most recently Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origins of Species. He's also the author of a monthly column in the New York Times on remarkable creatures. So there are lines open, and we also have this email. We have a couple of emails that have come in. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we go to phone calls, starting with Henry from Duluth. Hello, Henry.
Hi, I have a question. I was wondering which variety of mammoth would be selected for cloning, the pygmy axillus or the columbi of like the North American grasslands or the primigenus, like the Jarkov specimen?
Well, Henry, you've already demonstrated you know more about mammoths than I do. So as Kathleen clarified, it's not my research program. I think what it would come down to is if they try to attempt it by cloning from cells, it will all depend upon the quality of material that's available. So that species that is best preserved that has the least damage to cells, the greatest possibility of having its the nuclei bearing its genetic material intact. I think that's where the energy will be focused.
Thanks, Henry, for the call. Here's a question about fish. Jim from Green Bay asks, I heard as a student that goldfish could be flash frozen in some kind of liquid N2, later on could be thawed out and would swim away. Do you think that's true?
No, I don't think that's true. I don't think anything with a fairly complex organs, tissues, cells, they're not going to survive flash freezing too well. Things, individual cells will. So we can store our cells in deep freezers, and we've been doing this for many decades. We can store bacteria and yeast and all sorts of things. So individual cells can be flash frozen in a preservative. But as soon as you have something that's fairly thick and three-dimensional, it's pretty hard to make that freeze in such a way that there won't be damage upon thawing. So I'm skeptical of the goldfish story.
Uh-huh. Mike from Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, if you were to revive or to clone a woolly mammoth, by the way, there are specimens that were intact that thawed out. I don't know whatever happened to them. One, I think, was up in Newfoundland or someplace. The problem is where do you find a mate for it? You know, you got a genetic entity, a bottleneck of sorts, and no way to diversify that species. Because you don't have a mate for it. What do you do now?
Well, that's a great point. So you're thinking ahead. So, you know, I think all the effort will be to get one, and then everyone will have to go, all right, well, now what are we going to do with one? So either you're going to have to clone from multiple individuals that represent different sexes. I guess, now this one might kind of make you cringe a little bit. You know, the other possibility is, and it wouldn't be then a pure mammoth line, I don't know if it's possible that maybe mammoths would mate with elephants, which wouldn't necessarily be, you know, then you wouldn't have the mammoth characters breeding true anymore. But it is one way that that individual could you know, be perpetuated in some way. But no, you would need to clone from different individuals, you know, boy and girl mammoths, and start your stock that way.
Hmm. And then you'd have a mam-el, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Mike, for your call. We go to Barbara from Madison. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I was listening to your program. It's very interesting. And when you were talking about people being outside, how they adapted, I was participating in a program called Outward Bound. It was a survival school. And I was only there for 6 weeks in the winter in the mountains.
Ooh.
And after the 6 weeks, I couldn't be inside. My body had adapted to being in 20 degrees, and, you know, I didn't feel cold when I went outside, but I certainly felt very hot when I was inside at, say, 72 degrees.
Oh, my gosh. And tell me about that process. Was it real cold for the first couple of days? Were there things you did to adapt?
It was terrible.
I bet.
It was amazing. And also, we were only allowed a certain amount of food, and so you adapted to that. So just to eat a normal meal when I came back seemed like an overabundance to me.
Professor Carroll.
Yeah, well, this certainly makes sense. And I think your experience is just what a mammal would go through, which is changes in metabolism on exposure to the cold, changes obviously because of your diet, shift in the balance of you know, how much fat's being stored, how it's being burned, things like this, in order to keep your internal temperature up. Yeah, given a rapid shift back to, you know, other conditions, as you say, sort of just inside conditions, your thermostat was probably running, you know, on different cues. So when we talk about adaptation, there's sort of two dimensions to this. One is, you know, an individual just adapting to new circumstances, and we and other animals are fairly adaptable to living in different circumstances, just like we live through the four seasons. But in the longer term, adaptation means evolutionary change to most biologists. And so, of course, humans aren't necessarily changing it. They're not changing at all in those short circumstances. They're merely showing sort of the plasticity of their metabolism when exposed to different elements. But your experience certainly makes a lot of sense physiologically.
Mm. Was it a good experience, Barbara?
It was. And, you know, we had about 30 people involved in my troop, and not all of them adapted. Some people suffered the entire time.
Ooh, and they stayed with it for the whole time?
Well, no, actually, some of them had to go.
Huh.
because they suffered. And actually, it was the people with darker skins that had trouble. I think that because I'm a nice Nordic girl, my body adapted quicker.
Oh, that's interesting. Could that be, Professor Carroll?
Well, that could be, you know, because of your ancestors. I mean, there's no doubt. So humans spread out of Africa about 60,000, beginning about 60,000 years ago, and you know, settled on six continents. And there's no doubt, if you look at people living at, you know, high altitude in South America or high altitude in Asia, they are physiologically adapted to those environments in different ways than, say, our, you know, Aleutian Islanders, which are in different ways than, say, you know, people living in the Caribbean or, you know, around the equator. So over longer term, and you know, if you have Nordic ancestry, you know, the people that went north and probably, you know, one of the adaptations of becoming lighter was actually to allow sunlight to help us produce vitamin D. So I'm also a light-skinned Celtic background. That's an adaptation to low sunlight, high latitude environment. So in longer periods of time, there's no doubt, if you look across, you know, all of humanity, all those differences we see among each other, from sort of you know, being, you know, barrel-chested, being slightly built, skin darkness, skin lightness, things like this, they do reflect adaptation of humans to these different climates that they've settled in.
That's fascinating. Thanks, Barbara. I think you can settle a long-standing argument in our family right now. We were talking about people making adaptations, living outside and using furs to keep warm, human beings, explorers, etc. We have this fight in my – it's not a fight. It's a disagreement. We have this dog who's a soft-coated Wheaton Terrier, and he's got all of this hair. I mean, it's got tons of fur is what it is. It's tons of fur, too much fur, but beautiful, beautiful coat. And he needs to be groomed every now and then, or it gets matted. And every year, as soon as it starts getting a little cold, the family says, you can't cut his hair because he's going to get cold because he needs a winter coat. Well, he's got so much hair that I'm thinking, it doesn't make any difference to him, but I wonder if it does make a difference to him, does it?
Oh boy, I don't know if I'm weighing in on a family dispute, but
I don't think anybody's listening.
With the dog here, I'm going to say, yeah, it probably does matter. And
does it?
Realize that all of our dog breeds, you know, they mostly have been bred in the last couple of centuries, you know, for aesthetic reasons. They're not the end of long adaptive processes, you know, that have taken place in nature. So, you know, most of these dogs have not had any amount of time to sort of, you know, adapt to, you know, either our living rooms or the backyard. So the long fur, you know, I think when in doubt, given our climate, I'd
keep
let
it real
out.
Long. All right, okay. They were right. I was wrong. It's okay. Here's a Cheryl from Lancaster. You must know, Sean Carroll, about Mary Anning, the poor and undereducated fossil hunter from England who made some of the most important discoveries of the 19th century. She just finished a historical novel about her last night. Can you mention and describe her and Elizabeth Philpott, I guess, who is associated with her? I'm not familiar with her.
Yeah, so Mary Anning, so it's a great story, and this is talk about coincidence. So there's a new novel by Tracy Chevalier, who wrote The Girl with the Pearl Earring, about it's a novelized account of Mary Anning's life. I don't know whether I'm happy or unhappy about this, but she named the book Remarkable Creatures.
Ooh.
Came out after my book, and I thought, well...
Oh, you can't do that.
Well, you can.
Can you?
You can, and it may have been too late. It may have been too close together in time to do anything about that. But, and then, you know, funny enough, her book is about... a fossil hunter, in this case, Mary Anning, and my book contains a lot of stories about fossil hunters.
Sure.
I'm sort of hoping that her best-selling clout kind of has some spillover effect for me. So
you're doing okay with your book, too.
I'm not going to complain yet until I know that there's, you know, either terrible confusion about the books. Now, I guess, you know, on Amazon, buy both, right?
Exactly.
So Mary Anning was one of the early fossil collectors in Britain, and what was going on about the turn of the century was there was a lot of discovery of amazing creatures that were literally tumbling out of the cliffs and hillsides in England. And this included things like mosasaurs and plesiosaurs and things like this, extinct marine reptiles and things like this. And she started these excavations at an early age. So I would she was born right around the turn of the century. But as a young girl, and then throughout her life, she collected some of the most well-preserved specimens, and they were purchased and put in the leading museums of the time. So this included, you know, ichthyosaurs, plesiosaurs, things like this. And it's just incredible. I think her first find may have been, somewhere in her early age. Unfortunately, I don't know her story exactly, but certainly by the time she was a teenager, she was making these sorts of finds. And so she, if you go to the British, for example, the Natural History Museum in London, you see some of these most spectacular fossils that are mounted on the walls there have Mary Anning as credited as their discoverer. Hmm. So a woman, B, an amateur, and C, before really the understanding of what these animals represented in terms of Earth's history, her personal story is a great one.
And there are a lot of those kinds of stories in your book, too, because a lot of these people, these adventurers, took incredible risks and had this phenomenal sense of what lies beyond that took them all over the globe to things that had not been discovered before. And a lot of this is fairly recent.
Right. I mean, the book does start about the same time that Mary Anning was finding these things. In fact, I debated with myself whether or not Mary Anning was going to be one of the people that was in the book. But I decided that the people who are in the book had to sort of emerge more as part of sort of the fabric of the scientific series that unfolded. And so I decided not to include Mary, which is probably even better relative to the confusion about the two books. But, the people that I talk about, I cover about 200 years of natural history and some of the most daring and important expeditions that were ever undertaken, often by several people who were complete amateurs, with no formal training at all, and who, risked their lives just to explore the unknown, whether that was the Amazon or the deserts of the Mongolian desert or the Malay Archipelago or East Africa. They're all driven by this passion to explore, and the people I put in the book all made major discoveries that moved our understanding of the history of life forward.
And where did you get your passion for exploring?
Well, I think that's in all of us. I really do. I think that, we like adventure stories, and we like, the daring do and the surprises and the drama and the obstacles faced and things like that. So as I learned over the years, just for my own hobby reading about various people who had done these amazing things, probably began with my understanding Darwin and his 5-year voyage, I thought that, and to know all this material over, reading lots of years, that took a lot of books. And I thought, well, how can I share this with other people without them having to read as much as I had read? And I thought that if I just focused on the central experience of these people's lives, their expedition, where they went, what they found, what obstacles they encountered, that I could cover a fair amount of ground in a relatively compact space. So roughly each explorer, or maybe if it's a pair of explorers, get about a chapter. And my idea was that each chapter would sort of take a reader to a different place of the world encountering new and different things. And if it was bedtime reading, they could read one chapter, sort of fall asleep with visions of, Mongolian dinosaurs in their heads. And then the next night, they'd move on to the Arctic and to some other sorts of creatures. So it was a way, in my mind, to sort of bring out the passion for exploring and the great achievements of these people, because this was only, again, a short while ago that we really knew nothing about what was living on the planet, and we knew less than nothing about what had preceded it.
Yeah, isn't that something? Sean Carroll is our guest this hour. His book is Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures in the Search for the Origins of Species. He is also now writing a monthly column for the New York Times. It's also titled Remarkable Creatures. His most recent one is when built-in antifreeze beats a winter coat, which is January 19th. He's a professor of genetics and molecular biology at UW-Madison, and he is director of the Carroll Laboratory, investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. So we're welcoming phone calls for Sean. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we have quite a few emails coming in today, too, so we'll take more of those. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We want to tell you a couple things. One is on a related topic, we have mentioned the work that is going on with a frozen zoo, and the director of head of research, Dr. Betsy Dresser, who was also on that 60 Minutes piece, is going to be with us. She's director of the Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species. She'll be with us next Monday at 10 o'clock. Tomorrow, tomorrow, I wanted to tell you that the first hour of the program, we are going to be speaking with Chip Duncan, who's a documentary filmmaker from Milwaukee, who is currently in Port-au-Prince. He's with Rescue International, and one of the doctors who's been performing surgeries will also join us from Port-au-Prince. And so that's the first part of our program tomorrow, and we'll be looking at rescue efforts and what's most effective over the long haul. Second hour of our program, this guy's really good, Julian Zelizer. You've heard him many times on our show. His latest book is Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. So that's all coming up tomorrow. All right, 800-486-8655 is our number, and we go to Jean from Elkhorn next, Sean. Hi, Jean.
Yes, good morning. I'm glad to be on the radio today. Thank you. I missed the 60 Minutes report, but I was very fascinated with the topic that you're talking about this morning. I'm calling today to can you clarify how the Hughes Institute, is there some implications as far as our genetic, you called yourself a genetic engineer, I believe. Now, is there implications with our genetics integrity with our animal species that are domestic cows and pigs? And maybe you could just address your work a little bit more on that side.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you're driving for. So, you know, my work is involved in basic biological research and trying to understand how animals develop and how they've evolved. And so I do a lot of work in the area of genetics and understanding how the genes work that control the making and patterning of animal bodies. Now, you're talking about domesticated breeds, and we understand a lot about what's gone on as humans have domesticated animals for our own purposes, whether that's as food products or for transportation or whatever it might be. So that has been, or you know, dogs as companions or cats as companions, things like this. So what's gone on since in the last, say, 10,000 years, depending upon the animal you're talking about, is that, you know, humans have bred and selected animals that have traits that we desire, whether that's, you know, larger muscle mass for the dinner table or the ability to fetch a duck out of the water. So we have been the major architects of those animals' evolution for the last 10,000 years. In terms of bringing species back from extinction, then that's just sort of an extension of our activity, I guess, as architect.
I wondered if you're part of gene splicing, I guess, is where you're adding an orange and a frog gene together. The Hughes Institute isn't involved in that kind of activity?
Basic research is involved in understanding how genes work. In terms of generating anything, whether it's crop plants or any other types of genetic engineering is regulated by either the USDA or the FDA or National Institutes of Health in terms of experimentation. So there's quite a deal of regulation in terms of what can be done. So in laboratories, we're often splicing, you know, fly genes to fly genes or mouse genes to mouse genes or putting genes into bacteria in order to produce things that would be of therapeutic or medical interest, but this has been going on since the mid-1970s. But it's all highly regulated. These experiments are conducted under protocols that have to be approved by institutional and federal bodies. So researchers are not free to just do anything that occurs to them. They have to consider beforehand what the possible outcomes of those experiments would be.
I look forward to reading your book. Thank you.
All right, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. We go next to June from Toronto. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen. And hello to your guest. I didn't catch his name.
Sean Carroll. Hi, Professor June. Carroll.
Professor Carroll. This is kind of in the world of fantasy, but for some reason, maybe something I saw on television, I've been thinking about woolly mammoths. And the idea that in the past, recent past, where they thought about with genetic material they had to bring him back to life in the sense of cloning him. And I've been wondering about animal rights. In Spain recently, they passed laws against providing rights for simian creatures, but I wonder how happy that woolly mammoth would be if he were brought back to life. He's got 20 inches of fur on his top coat and huge tusks, and all of which he would be all alone. Would he be able to have guidance into what a woolly mammoth does? I mean, no mother, no father, and as a previous caller said, no girlfriend. I worry about that woolly mammoth.
Well, I think those are very thoughtful worries, and
yes.
I think that that's what we as a society, as a culture, have to decide when we engage in things is, you know, what's the best way to do things. So the scientists will say, you know, we can really now see, because of things we've learned, that it's not complete fantasy to imagine bringing back a woolly mammoth. And then people could say, yeah, but is it the right thing to do? And what would be the quality of life? And, for example, there's still considerable risks involved in cloning. Whether that's been sheep or mice or other sorts of animals, there's certainly been experiences where there are health issues with cloned animals. So to move forward, we have to ask those sorts of questions. You know, what is the quality of life? What's the risk of pain and suffering in any creature that we would produce in this particular way? And you know, I think a good guidance, you know, to science is that, you know, we should be reducing suffering in the world, not increasing it. So we should be taking into account the quality of life that a woolly mammoth would have, maybe by either thinking about giving it mates or giving it at least companions in the case of, you know, other elephants or things like this. But these are certainly, you know, very worthwhile things to be thinking about. We just can't just plunge forward and without imagining, you know, what we're doing.
I think it's great you were just thinking about woolly mammoths the other day, June.
Well, I think I saw something on television.
You probably saw our guest.
They talked about woolly mammoths and and the climate they lived in.
Huh. Yeah.
And I always had a feeling about woolly mammoths, you know?
Really?
One of my favorite non-existent animals.
Thanks for your call, June.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm interested because I've seen these things before and I know people eat them. You had this great column in December in the New York Times. Have you ever tried to think up the worst meal you could imagine? How about blue-ringed octopus, floral egg crab, basket shell snails, and puffer fish? Why were those things brought to mind, Professor Carroll?
Because they're all deadly. They were brought to mind because it sounds like a reasonable seafood buffet, but it turns out they all share one thing in common, which is they're all harboring one of the most potent toxins we know. And what's strange about that is that they all belong to sort of different parts of the animal world, the octopus, the fish, the crabs, and yet they all have the same chemical in them, and that's an unusual thing. So in the rest of the column, I explore how that's happened. And what they've done is they found a way to exploit a toxin available in their environment for self-defense. The downside of that is that when humans eat these animals, which all of them have at one time or another been consumed at least by some humans, we're not resistant to those toxins, and we suffer. So pufferfish is pretty famous for poisoning and killing people in places where it's considered a delicacy. It's a fine line delicacy. A little bit of pufferfish can make your lips tingle. A little bit more can kill you.
Mm.
So that's adventures. That's more adventure in eating than I ever want to have. But
right.
The idea of the column was to make people think about sort of self-defense among animals, and in this case, a pretty remarkable strategy of turning a toxin available in the environment to one's own defense.
Mm-hmm. And you also write about, I've always wondered who these people are, the people who decide that they're going to tempt fate and eat some of this, and they don't make it.
Yes. Yeah, they're always candidates for the Darwin Award, right? So I've come across stories. I know of one case in the medical literature where there's a newt in Oregon that is toxic for the same reasons. And a person at a drinking party swallowed a newt and died of newt poisoning. I mean, you know, how does the family feel at that funeral?
Really?
And then other people many people have tempted fate with the pufferfish because it is a delicacy and its preparation is an art form in Japan. And I guess one of the most famous cases was a revered kabuki actor who felt that he was resistant to the poison and ordered up 4 pufferfish livers. And he was wrong about his resistance.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Let's go. Thanks, June, for your call. We go to Robert next from Stevens Point. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Yeah, so I'd like to ask the guest if his book covers anything about Italian efforts to recreate the giant cattle known as aurochs.
No, I don't cover that in my book. I'm actually doing a little bit of homework on domesticated breeds these days, and you're in the right neighborhood that there are, various ideas underfoot of how to bring back creatures that have not been gone for very long. I'm not familiar. I'm not expert or knowledgeable about this effort in Italy, but in general, we've got to realize that most of our domesticated breeds are relatively young. They were tamed over the last 10,000 years or less of civilization, and so their genetic distance from wild stocks is pretty close. So there's lots of interest in what we may be able to either bring back or what we may be able to modify that's currently living to have some of the traits of other creatures that are gone.
Okay. Thanks very much for your call. We have a follow-up thing here on the goldfish, if you don't mind,
sure.
Professor Carroll. When I was in grade school, a scientist came to our school and spoke to us about the magic of science. One thing he had was liquid nitrogen that he dipped many things into. One thing he dipped was a goldfish, which froze solid, and he tapped it on the table and the microphone to show how hard it had become, and then he dropped it into a bowl of water, and woof, by the end of the lecture, the goldfish was swimming around in the bowl.
All right, I stand corrected. Fantastic. Well, I'll have to look up into flash freezing of goldfish. So maybe there's a lot more knowledge about that than I was aware of.
Maybe there is.
That's great.
Who knows? So it must be hard to do this column because there's so much for you to write about. So science is so miraculous for you to choose one thing for a monthly column. It must be difficult.
Well, no, actually, I think I've got so many stories. It's hard to decide which one to.
Yeah,
focus
that's
on.
What I mean, that's what I meant.
Time, yeah. Well, it's and obviously there's stories still emerging. So the idea I had in the column was that I was going to dig up stories that had not gotten a lot of attention, that maybe were not a single discovery, but a set of discoveries that sort of flew below the radar and then sort of bring them to the fore. So those are a little fewer. But, if I characterize it that way, I'm not writing news. I'm not writing things right out of. New discoveries that are in the press. I'm writing things that take a little bit of digging. So that does cut down the number of potential stories, but I've got a pretty large roster here of candidates that I'm sifting through.
I'm sure you do. Well, this was great fun. And it's so interesting to me that you got highlighted for this woolly mammoth feature, and people probably think that you are working on this, and you've got this whole host of other research, et cetera, going on, and 60 Minutes talks to you about woolly mammoths.
Yeah, well, I think I understood that risk.
Right.
Part of it is, a lot of what I've been doing, Kathleen, is talking to the public about science, and I think that just comes with the territory, is sort of representing a lot of things that other people are doing just besides myself. So I'll take the risk of some confusion. That's all right.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. It was great fun.
Thanks for having me,
Kathleen. Thank you. Our guest this hour, Sean Carroll. He's a professor of genetics and molecular biology at UW-Madison, investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, director of the Carroll Laboratory. And you can go to – all right, it's a little bit long here, but it's MOLBIO – www.wis.edu/Carol to get more information about his website. His books include Remarkable Creatures, Epic Adventures, and The Search for the Origins of Species. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks also to Jan Anderson for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. I just wanted to tell you, because I know that we become like family to you after a while, and many of you have had a chance to call in to our program and speak with John Treader. John had a stroke last week, and he is recovering from that, and his language is coming back. He'll be doing some therapy to get his body strong once again. But I know that you have a special relationship, many of you, with John, because he's been such a kind, gracious, fun person to have as a volunteer for so many years. So if you'd like to wish him well, you can either go to our Facebook page where we have put an address if you'd like to send him a card, or just send him messages on Facebook and we'll get him over to him during the course of this week. That would be great. And the address is on Facebook. So you go to Facebook, Kathleen Dunn Show, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and there you'll get the info. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks for your calls. This is the Ideas Network.